most of them focused on the double jeopardy collateral estoppel issues, and I'm going to get to that, but I'd like to start with a different issue first for this morning's purposes, and then that's argument five in our brief, and that concerns the jury instruction that was given by the court to the jury in connection with their duty. And the reason we want to raise that issue now is because there appears to be a split in the counties on how that's instructed, and in the event of a retrial, we're hoping that that issue would be resolved in this appeal. But I'd like to direct the court to the language that the trial judge used when he instructed the jury in terms of reconciling conflicts in testimony. He suggested to the jury that they had a duty to reconcile conflicts in the testimony, if possible, to make one harmonious story of it all. And despite our exhaustive search, we have not been able to find a case that suggests that is the duty of the jury in a criminal matter, and we would suggest to the court that it was error to instruct in that fashion. The instruction in Sussex County is slightly different. It does suggest to the jury that if reasonably possible, they can reconcile conflicts in testimony to make one harmonious story of it all, but that's, they don't have to, and they're free to reject evidence that they find is not worthy of belief. And the nuance in this particular circumstance is the use of the word duty. The jury has a duty to make one harmonious story of it all. And the reason we believe that's an important issue in the defense of a criminal case is, in most instances, it is the state that puts forth substantial evidence to establish a story of how a crime occurred, and this instruction that the jury somehow has a duty to make a harmonious story of it all, they don't focus on their primary responsibility, which is to decide whether the state has proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt, because that is their duty.
Well, can I interrupt you here? Granted, the language talks about a duty to reconcile inconsistencies, but then it goes on and says, if reasonably possible. Doesn't that kind of take the wind out of your sails in terms of the jury is not being told, you must take all of this evidence you've heard and make it all fit? It's rather, you must try to do that, and if you can't, you can't.
I appreciate the question, the comment, Your Honor. That we would suggest to the court, by using the word duty, that the jury is left with the feeling that they're compelled to do that. And that's not how it's instructed, at least in Sussex County, where the word duty does not appear in the instructions. So it would be clear to a jury that only if possible should they make a harmonious story of it all, but they don't have to. And that's the distinction. And it's our suggestion that it does create some confusion.
Well, how did that affect the outcome in this case, if at all?
Your Honor, I can't really say how it affected the outcome in this case. I think it's, in terms of the issues that we presented, it's more of an academic issue. Arguments 7 and 8 about the conspiracy accomplice issues are what we believe had the most impact on the outcome of the case, and I'd like to move to those at this point, with your permission. As we suggested in the first argument, and throughout our briefs in this case, what the state was permitted to do, despite the fact that Bruce Banther was acquitted of conspiracy in his first trial, was simply retry the exact same case. And the only limitation that the trial judge imposed upon the state after we had filed a motion in limine was to suggest that you can make all the same arguments, introduce all the same evidence, but you can't use the word conspiracy. And indeed, in the course of the state's presentation, nobody suggested that. But the state was permitted, and it's clear from the record, to suggest to the jury expressly and implicitly that Bruce Banther and John Schmitz agreed to commit the murder of Dennis Ravers, that they planned the murder in advance, and the state directed the jury's attention to a number of pieces of evidence, to establish that, and that ultimately a murder was committed, proving a conspiracy to commit murder. That's what the state did. They suggested to the trial judge that you can be an accomplice even though you've been acquitted of conspiracy in a first trial. And indeed, they're right from our perspective that you can do that, but only in a very limited circumstance. And the case that they cited, the Travis case, was the limited circumstance. In Travis, the defendant was acquitted of conspiracy in the first degree, convicted of murder in the first degree in his first trial. In his retrial, he suggested that he could not be convicted as an accomplice in the second trial because he had been acquitted of conspiracy. And the trial judge said, well, there is one circumstance, at least he could think of, where you could be an accomplice without being a conspirator, and that's if you acted unilaterally. And in the Travis case, the facts were that the victim was apparently being assaulted by the principal, and he began to run away. And without consultation, there was no evidence of consent, assent, or contact between the principal and the accomplice tripped the victim. The victim fell to the ground. The accomplice hit the victim several times, and the principal killed him with the bat.
Can you help us understand your argument from a temporal point of view? You seem to be suggesting that if you're acquitted as a conspirator, then nothing that happened, no evidence about anything that preceded arriving at the scene of the crime should have been presented to the jury. That basically you're cutting off all of the evidence of planning, or is that what you're saying the trial judge should have done?
There may be some pieces of pretrial contact between Bruce Banther and the victim, which would clearly be admissible because they would not go to any notion that it was a conspiracy. For instance, the evidence was that Bruce Banther met with the victim in Washington, D.C. that day. And certainly,
Help us focus on the exact evidence that was improperly admitted and that results in reversible error rather than just the general theory that you shouldn't have been able to talk about something a conspirator would have done. What was the prejudice to your client? What particular pieces of evidence?
Your Honor, I guess it's easier to focus on how the state used the pieces of evidence. In the arguments that they made, both in opening and closing, they suggest things like, now, and I'll quote, now if they planned this together and they committed together as accomplices, doesn't matter which one swung the act, one is the principal and one is the accomplice.
Your problem is, that is, your contention is not so much that the trial court admitted evidence that it shouldn't have in the second trial, but rather what it did, or how it erred, was in allowing the state to characterize that evidence as involving an agreement. Is that right?
I would suggest to you that's right. That's closer to what our problem is. But there is at least one case out there, the Symes case, and it's cited in our brief, which says a particular theory is foreclosed if in the previous trial the defendant was acquitted on that theory. And in this case, since the state had one theory, and that theory is that Bruce Banther and John Schmitz planned this event in advance, and John Schmitz went to the site where the murder was committed and laid in wait. Bruce Banther conned Dennis Ravers into meeting him in Delaware.
Well, the magic word here, the magic concept that creates the problem is agreement, isn't it? Because it's that word that is duplicated both in the conspiracy statute and in the accomplice statute. Correct?
That's part of it, Your Honor, but how about planned together? That's something that appears in the accomplice statute. And if somebody plans something together, then you... the concept of agreement, yes.
Well, and are you saying that the accomplice liability theory should not have been submitted to the jury at all?
Oh, no. No, we're suggesting that the accomplice liability theory was appropriate, but only if the jury was instructed that Mr. Banther could be found guilty as an accomplice if you conclude that he engaged in some unilateral act without consultation with the principal, and in that way aided in the commission of the crime.
Well, that's when I got really answering my temporal question. And we agree that you can conspire to do something and then it never happens, but you still engaged in a conspiracy. And we can probably agree that you can commit an act that comes up at the point of time of the act and you never conspired before the act. And we seem to want to draw some sharp lines in this case based on the acquittal of conspiracy at the first trial. And how do we draw the line?
Well, I guess you start with the opening statement and limiting the statement from suggesting to the jury that there was an agreement or a plan. The state should be permitted to introduce historical evidence of things that occurred, for instance, the Banther meeting with Ravers in Washington, D.C. We have concerns about how they established that Ravers came to Delaware, and the other argument, the Crawford issue, that I want to get to at some point, that Ravers appeared at the Harrington police station, spoke to a dispatcher, and discussed a meeting with Bruce Banther. Now, that evidence, nobody mentions John Schmidt. The John Schmidt's role in this case doesn't come to light until Bruce Banther makes statements after he's in custody. So in terms of those two pieces of evidence, I think the state, if the court concludes that the conversation that Dennis Ravers had with the dispatcher is admissible, then certainly those two pieces of evidence establish Banther's earlier contact, the arrangement of the meeting, and the state could introduce evidence of where the murder took place. Those are pieces of evidence I think are admissible, irrespective of the lack of a conspiracy theory that can be suggested to the jury. And so you can put Bruce Banther in Farmington on the night of the murder. You can put Bruce Banther in Washington earlier that day. You can infer a meeting between those two based on Raver's comments. And we know that the state can introduce evidence that Banther at one time lived near the murder scene, that they did during the course of the trial, and that a murder was committed on Mezeboff Road. One of the things that the state did in this case, I mean, there was very little evidence pre-trial that was of any importance to the state. Now, some of the things that they introduced evidence of was that John Schmitz had
gone pre-trial
or pre-homicide. John Schmitz had borrowed a truck 7 or 8 hours before from someone, and the state suggested that indicated planning for carrying the body away from the scene. Now, I guess they could suggest that John Schmitz borrowed a truck, but they can't argue to the jury that from that you have to infer that John Schmitz and Bruce Banther agreed or planned to commit this murder, and the initial step was borrowing the truck, and that's evidence that they had an agreement or conspiracy to kill Dennis Ravers, because the first jury concluded they didn't have a conspiracy.
Let me make sure I understand this. Your heading in your brief for argument 8 says the trial court erred when it allowed the state to argue defendant's guilt based on accomplice liability theory. But as I understand your argument today, it could have been appropriate for the state to argue based on accomplice liability and could have been correct for the trial judge to charge on that. If the state had not been allowed to introduce evidence and argue about an agreement or planning the crime.
Also,
so if you just help me by letting me get this out.
Okay.
It's not meant to suggest to you what the answer is. It's helping me sort through it. The accomplice statute, as I understand your argument to suggest, is relevant and appropriate if the argument was allowed to be made, evidence was allowed to be introduced, and the jury was charged that accomplice liability in this case could be based on aiding, counseling, or attempting to aid the other person in committing the crime. But the error was, evidence was introduced, argument was made, and instruction was given that guilt could be based upon not only that, but an agreement and in planning the crime as well, and that's the conflict with the acquittal on conspiracy. Is that fair?
It's close, Your Honor. The only thing that I would suggest that maybe a further limitation is if the state's theory is that Banther was, as part of the agreement to kill Dennis Rapers, counseling John Schmidt on how he could commit the murder. The Travis case, the only...
All right, so I would be correct then if I further modified it only by saying they should have been able to argue, introduce evidence about, and the jury would be instructed on aiding or attempting to aid the other person in committing the crime.
Unilaterally.
I'll get there. Just work with me.
That's correct.
Yep.
Okay. And further modification would be that was without assent or conversation or agreement with the co-defendant. It was unilateral. And that's what the Travis court's trial judge suggested. And we don't take any issue with that because it makes sense.
In Travis, the court was just trying to reconcile the fact that there was a conviction on one claim, on one count, and an acquittal on the conspiracy count.
That's correct. And it was consistent with the evidence introduced at trial. There wasn't any evidence that there was a conversation between the principal and the accomplice or any previous association.
It wasn't a discussion about the collateral estoppel effect of the acquittal on the conspiracy count, isn't that right?
Well, I think there was. The defendant asserted that the state was collaterally stopped from suggesting that he was an accomplice because he had been acquitted of conspiracy, and that he...
Is it all in one trial, or is that a retrial case?
Your Honor, so much material here. I can't honestly say I know the answer to that. I do know this, that the defendant suggested he can't be a conspirator if he's been acquitted of, an accomplice if he's been acquitted of a conspiracy. And under the facts of that case, the trial judge said, yes, you can, because the jury could have looked at these circumstances and concluded that you acted spontaneously and unilaterally, and therefore you could have aided in the commission of the crime.
But here we don't know whether your client was convicted of the murder as an accomplice or as a principal.
No, we don't. But we do know that the indictment charged our client and John Schmidt jointly with the murder, and that we do know, and it's identified at some length in the brief, that the state's theory of the case, presented in opening, presented in the evidence, presented in summation, presented in rebuttal, is that these two men planned to kill Dennis Rapers, and then they went through the timeline, what happened at the bar of the truck, the meeting, the suggestion that Mr. Banther did not want Dennis Rapers to know that John Schmitz, a man who was 6'5 and 270 pounds, was waiting out in the woods for him, so he told him some other guy, Charles, was going to be out there.
Counsel, I'd like to go back for a moment to a question that Justice Stalin asked, because I think there's been a blurring of two things. We all understand that you're contending that the state should not have been allowed to argue in opening or in closing that there's an agreement or a plan between these two persons to kill the victim. The question is, what evidence, if any, should not have been allowed into the record in order to avoid the error of suggesting to the jury that there was an agreement or a plan pre-homicide? That is, if you took out the erroneous characterization, as you call it, and left the same record intact, would there be any error?
I have to reflect on that, Your Honor. I'm sure there's something, some piece of evidence in there, but the state would still be able to, I think, put on a case where they describe, for instance, the post-homicidal acts, but they all go to infer a conspiracy. So I would suggest to the court that the state is probably stuck with Bruce Banther meeting him earlier in the day, arranging a meeting in or around with the individuals killed, and the fact that a homicidal event took place. And then...
And what evidence is carved out?
I guess it's the arguments that were made.
Well, put another way, if all the evidence was in, would it be error simply to argue an agreement in planning and counseling and allow an instruction which suggested to the jury that was a possible basis for accomplice liability? would that alone be sufficient, in your view, to warrant a reversal?
Absolutely. It was the only theory the state produced. Now, our position is the state is, because of the conspiracy acquittal, the state is stuck with one of two theories. Either Bruce Banther did it himself, or John Schmitz had nothing to do with it, although Mr. Schmitz has pled guilty to murder, or that during the course of a homicidal attack by John Schmitz, Bruce Banther, without consultation, participated.
You have just a little over 4 minutes left. Do you want to save your time or keep going?
I want to save my time. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'll address the three arguments in the order presented, but there were actually eight arguments in the opening brief. If there's any questions on the other five, I'll certainly attempt to answer those as well. Turning first to the argument five, that's the jury instruction that deals with conflicts in the testimony. It's a pattern jury instruction, and this court has held in the case of Cabrera, 2000 decision by this court, that the pattern jury instruction should be consulted in the first instance. There was no constitutional error here because, as has already been pointed out in the questioning, the instruction is only applicable where there is conflicting testimony or testimony that is inconsistent. In the state's answering brief, I pointed out that Mr. Banther hadn't actually identified what was inconsistent or conflicting in the testimony. Here, the evidence consisted of the state's case. Mr. Banther did not testify or present any defense witnesses. In the reply brief, Mr. Banther did indicate that, well, what was consistent was in the statements of Mr. Banther that were admitted during the state's case in chief. There was an inconsistency because Mr. Banther said that John Schmitz was the one who had struck the fatal blow with the axe and had killed Mr. Ravers, not Mr. Banther, and that was inconsistent with arguments or other evidence that the state was presenting. Nonetheless, the wording of the instruction, I think, is what's crucial here, and it says, if you find, and you have to look at the first part of the sentence there, if there is a qualification. If you find the testimony to be conflicting, that the jury has to make that determination first by reason of inconsistencies. It is your duty to reconcile it if reasonably possible, and as Justice Burke has pointed out, it's not a mandate, it's not a requirement that they have to do that if they can't reasonably do it. If it's not reasonably possible, then the testimony simply remains in conflict, and you can't then, as the instruction continues, so as to make one harmonious story of it all. This is really not much different than an Allen charge where you tell the jury that it's your obligation, your duty, your responsibility to continue to deliberate in good faith, and if you can, without consciously surrendering your own beliefs, reach a unanimous verdict, then that's your responsibility. But if you can't do that, then you can't do it. I don't think that the way this charge is worded, semantically dissecting it, imposes any different obligation or responsibility upon the jury. And I think the way it's worded is certainly appropriate here. Defendant is not entitled to any particular form of instruction. And as this court has held, the defendant's entitlement is to a correct statement of the substance of the law, and I think this particular pattern jury instruction dealing with conflicts in the evidence is an appropriate statement of the substance of the law. It's not an inaccurate characterization of the jury's responsibilities, and I think in this particular case there was no constitutional error in giving this particular form of pattern jury instruction here. Turning to the last two arguments, arguments 7 and 8, which have to deal with the difference between conspirator and accomplice liability here. The argument that was made pre-trial before the opening statements or any evidence presented by the defense was that the state should be precluded by virtue of the prior acquittal on the first-degree conspiracy allegation from arguing co-conspirator liability here. What the judge did after considering the matter, he did not make a decision the first day, but the second day made a decision that's quoted at length in the state's answering brief here. What the judge did was point out and relied heavily upon the Travis decision, an earlier Newcastle County Superior Court case dealing with a very analogous factual situation where someone had gone to trial on a first-degree murder charge and a first-degree conspiracy charge, had been acquitted at the first trial of the first-degree conspiracy charge and was now being retried on the homicide charge. And the question was, well, because of the acquittal in the prior trial, is the state now collaterally estopped from presenting evidence of vicarious liability in the form of an accomplice theory of liability here? I think the Travis case is what's instructive here. The trial judge cited that, and I think that's an appropriate delineation of the applicable law here.
Well, Mr. Williams, in the second trial, what was the state's factual theory of joint action? That is, what was, as a factual matter, what was the basis for the accomplice theory?
Well, I think the basis for the accomplice theory, and the difficulty here is that unlike Travis, where there were actually some witnesses who were present during the assault, the only people who are present during this homicide are Mr. Ravers, who's the victim, Mr. Schmitz, who does not testify, and Mr. Banther, who also does not testify. So we don't have direct testimony. Everything is inferential. But
I just asked you what the theory was, not the proof.
Sure. I'm sorry. The theory, I think, is twofold. The theory is that either Mr. Banther was the principal in that he was the one who struck the blow, the fatal blows with the axe, and the medical examiner who exhumed the body and did the autopsy said there were at least four fatal blows, or in the alternative that he was an accomplice to Mr. Schmitz, if Mr. Schmitz in fact was the one who struck the fatal blows. The state had no direct evidence as to which of the two individuals actually hit Mr. Ravers with the axe.
All right, now, what was the state's manner of proving accomplice liability, given that it was precluded from arguing that there was an agreement?
Well, I think what you do is you have to look at the statute on...
Well, I want to know what the state did.
Sure, and I think that's the clue, is you have you look at the statute and it talks about aids or assists someone. It's Section 271, I think it's B2, and that's what they were doing. They were talking about how this was all done. A lot of the evidence is certainly post-homicide. We don't know exactly when Mr. Ravers died, if he died instantly or if he died later on when the individuals were dismembering and attempting to burn the body. We don't know that. But we do know that even on the basis of Mr. Banther's own statements to the police, that he was at least assisting in the disposal of the body. That much he admits. Now, what the state was asking the jury to infer was that, well, we don't have direct proof as to who struck the fatal blow here. All we know is that these two individuals are at the scene, Mr. Ravers is killed, and this is the sum total of the evidence, and that was what was presented here.
Didn't the case proceed by way of explaining to the jury all the events that took place prior to the homicide, and that wouldn't a reasonable juror take from that, oh, well, these two men were planning a murder. They had an agreement. One of them got a car, one of them made a phone call, or, you know, lured him, and all that kind of thing, that... whether you use the word conspiracy or not, the facts that were presented and the argument that was presented to the jury were these two people agreed to commit this crime, and together they did. Isn't that really what was presented to the jury?
Well, I don't think that was what was presented to the jury, because we don't know that there actually was an agreement. All we know is that there are certain objective historical facts.
Well, didn't the state argue that there was an agreement? I thought that's what Mr. Howard was quoting, that that was the state's argument. These two agreed to do something.
Well, they agreed to do something. The question is exactly what did they agree to do? Did they agree to commit a homicide, or did they agree just to meet with Mr. Ravers and somehow attempt to persuade him to their point of view? There was this dispute about the
Let me turn the question from a different perspective. The state charged the conspiracy, so in the first trial, did you have a theory of the conspiracy, or you had to prove an overt act? Then there's an acquittal. What was the significance of the acquittal on conspiracy at the second trial? What did that eliminate as far as the state was concerned?
I think what it eliminated was proof that there was actually an agreement to commit a homicide. What it did not eliminate for purposes of accomplice liability theory was that there may have been an agreement to lure Mr. Ravers to this particular rural location. For what purpose was never specified. And that's, I think, as far as you can go with the state's evidence. But I think
then the state would not have been permitted to argue to the jury these two men agreed to commit a homicide.
No, because I think you would be collaterally stopped from that. That was the significance of the prior conspiracy acquittal. I think all you can say is they were working together towards some joint enterprise, but exactly what it was or what the parameters of the enterprise was, we don't know. As I said, Mr. Schmitz didn't testify, Mr. Banther didn't testify, and the only other person there was the decedent, Mr. Raver. So we don't know the answers to those questions. Nonetheless, the state's still not precluded from offering the evidence that it did, and from arguing vicarious liability as an accomplice. The jury had the choice here of deciding whether or not Mr. Banther was the principal or the accomplice, but the result would be the same. You would have liability for first-degree murder, whether you're the principal or whether you're the accomplice. The trial judge gave an appropriate instruction based upon the language of the statute.
In that instruction, did the trial judge use the language agreement or planning? I'm trying to find it in the appendix.
I don't think it's in the appendix. I couldn't find it either. It looks to me like it's...
I'm in the brief at page A-B-485, and I can't find it.
Yeah, I don't think that's it. I think it's it, in the trial transcript of February 2nd, 2004. It looks like it's at volume L, beginning on page 17, and continues on at least to 19. And what they say there, what the trial judge said, and this is the instruction to the jury, it says, a person indicted for committing an offense may be convicted either as a principal for acts which he committed himself or as an accomplice to another person guilty of committing the offense. With respect to the charges of murder in the first degree, and possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony, the state contends that the defendant may be found guilty either as a principal for acts he committed or as an accomplice if he intended to aid another person in committing some or all of the acts, some of the acts necessary for the commission of the offense. Then the judge goes and quotes this pertinent statutory section.
What's your response to this? On page L45 of the appendix, it's the argument made by the Deputy Attorney General to the jury about why the jury should convict on accomplice liability. And he says, a person who aids, counsels, or agrees or attempts to aid the principal in planning or committing the crime, assist the principal to commit the crime, is the accomplice. And legally, both are considered equally guilty. Then he says, in other words, the accomplice aided, counseled, agreed, or attempted to aid the principal in committing or in carrying out the crime. So that's what you have to find in order to find someone guilty as an accomplice. how, after all the discussion about not referring to conspiracy, agreeing, allowing, being allowed to argue agreement as to some things, he's allowed to argue to the jury that, in effect, if you find that he was a co-conspirator, you can find that he was an accomplice, because I'm going to be inclusive and argue that all of the elements found for an accomplice for accomplice liability in the statute are present in this case. And we have presumably established those facts beyond a reasonable doubt that support this argument. How could that happen?
Well, I think it happens because it's what the prosecutor is doing, simply quoting the statutory language.
But wait a minute. Wasn't it parsed on the theory that having been found not guilty of conspiracy, we have to be careful that there's no overlap between conspiracy and accomplice liability? And just as the judge did in Travis, we're going to delineate accomplice liability as it can be distinguished from planning, agreeing in a conspiracy context, and still be able to find someone guilty, if the facts support it, beyond a reasonable doubt, of accomplice liability. But we're going to avoid mixing and matching and, in effect, getting conspiracy in through the back door. Isn't that what this prosecutor argued to the jury?
No, I don't think so.
Why not? Because he's talking about, specifically, if you believe that the facts support that Banther assisted the principal by aiding him, counseling, agreeing, or attempting to aid him in planning or committing the crime, and the accomplice aided, counseled, agreed, or attempted to aid the principal in committing or in carrying out the times, quote, that's what you have to find in order to find someone guilty as an accomplice. Why isn't that a problem?
Well, I think it's not a problem for the same reason it's not a problem in Travis. If that was the problem, then the result would be that if you're acquitted of conspiracy at the first trial, then the state legally and logically is precluded then from arguing accomplice liability.
Unless one of us is missing the point here of Travis, if I understand Travis correctly, and Mr. Howard argued it correctly to me, or to us, he made the point that there were no facts in Travis that supported a theory that the principal and accomplice had ever consulted, had ever agreed, or attempted to plan what occurred. That the person, Travis, was an accomplice because he tripped the victim fleeing from the principal. So there wouldn't have been any argument in Travis that he agreed or attempted to agree or he planned or counseled with the co-defendant. So there wouldn't be any overlap of a conspiracy and an accomplice theory. It was neatly parsed, apparently, in Travis, and the facts supported parsing it. Where is that the case here?
Well, I think it's the case here because we simply don't know when people form certain specific intents. We don't know when Banther intended to aid Mr. Schmitz. If the theory is that Mr. Schmitz is principal, he strikes the blows, and Mr. Banther merely aids him. We don't know when temporarily that occurs. We know in Travis, because as I pointed out, there are some
other... talking about Travis. That's the 1992 Superior Court decision. Is that correct?
Correct.
So we wouldn't be bound by that.
Oh, no, you're not bound by it, but I think it is an accurate statement of the law, and it is what the trial judge relied upon and is the reasoning in his decision. And I think
Mr. Howard's argument would agree with you on that, that it is.
Yeah, I think it's accurate, and it delineates what the distinction is. For the conspiracy, you have to have a plan, and the plan has to be whatever the object of the conspiracy is.
Let me follow up on that in light of what the Chief Justice was asking you. On page 40 and 41 of Mr. Howard's brief, he quotes the state's argument, and one of the quotes is, the state submits that the evidence does show beyond any reasonable doubt that they planned and carried out this killing together. Is that a proper argument?
Well, I think it is in terms of what the plan was. The plan was certainly to lure Mr. Ravers to this location. They were both going to be there.
Well, that's the next page, where if the argument's repeated. The isolated location showing it was planned and carried out with Schmitz, etc. But it's this continued reference to the plan. and goes back to my earlier question, what was the significance of the acquittal on conspiracy if all of this pre-planning is still proper argument?
Well, I think it's proper argument in terms of what is the subject matter of the plan. Is the plan, one, to commit a homicide, or is the plan, two, simply to lure Mr. Rivers
into the investigation? Beyond any reasonable doubt, they planned and carried out this killing together. That's the quote of the state's argument. So there's no doubt there what the plan was, is there?
Well, yeah, I think there is. I think the plan there is still simply to lure him to that location.
Now,
we don't know.
Here's the exact quote. Let me quote, and I'll tell you when I get to the end of the quote. Quote, but the state submits that the evidence does show beyond any reasonable doubt that they planned and carried out this killing together. End quote.
Right, and I don't think that's an improper argument. I think you still don't know who's principal or who's accomplice there. You're just saying that they did this together.
But it suggests that you can find him guilty as an accomplice based on the fact they planned the killing together, doesn't it? And isn't that inconsistent with the finding of not guilty on conspiracy? It may have been fine if the argument were he aided or attempted to aid the other person in committing the crime. But is it a fair argument if it goes beyond that and says agreement or planning or counseling, which is inconsistent with the conspiracy finding? That's the rub.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I see your point, but I think the problem is, how do you flip that around? You still have to flip it around because you don't know who's principal and who's accomplice. You don't know who struck the fatal blow.
But don't you, under circumstances like this, don't you have to be more specific and say, if you, the jury, are going to find him guilty as an accomplice, you can only do it on this basis. You cannot do it on the basis of any view you might have of a plan that they had beforehand, or something to that effect, so that you take out of the equation what might be, under all the evidence that was presented, what might be the way the jury would look at it. And you say, no, you can't base your decision on this. If you're going to find him guilty as an accomplice, you're going to have to base it on something, you know, on these other factors. Wouldn't that have taken care of the problem?
Well, it certainly clarified the thing. And that's probably something either the judge or defense counsel, the judge could have instructed or defense counsel could have argued here. I think
Mr. Williams, I want to change subjects slightly before you sit down. Tell us what you think the state of the law is after the United States Supreme Court decision in Crawford on what hearsay comes in and what's the definition of testimonial. Is any court defined that?
Well, some courts have taken the opportunity and I guess attempted to delineate what's testimonial. What the U.S. Supreme Court said was that there were, I guess, three different possibilities here, but they didn't really say which one was most appropriate, and some of the three possibilities are more restrictive than others. They did say that if you have testimony at a prior judicial proceeding, a preliminary hearing or a suppression hearing or something like that, that's testimonial evidence. If you're making a statement to a police officer, police interrogation, that is in the nature of testimonial evidence, even though it's not testimony in an actual judicial proceeding. Here, I don't think Crawford versus Washington is implicated, because while there were statements made by Mr. Ravers to the police dispatcher as to the change of location, where the meeting was going to take place on February 12th, that was not in response to any police interrogation. It was simply information that Mr. Ravers had volunteered to a dispatcher at the Harrington Police Department. So I don't think Crawford versus Washington would be involved here. As to exactly which of our hearsay exceptions are eviscerated by Crawford versus Washington, I'm not really sure now, but I think when you're dealing with prior testimony, you're not going to use the Ohio versus Roberts old reliability tests anymore. You're going to have to use whether it's testimonial in nature or not as a test, and the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't delineated exactly what is or what isn't testimonial, but I think here, given what the U.S. Supreme Court has told us in Crawford, that neither of the two hearsay issues that were raised, the one dealing with a pawnbroker, Mr. West, and the police dispatcher, Mr. Wood, would be excluded under Crawford versus Washington.
And tell me why, since Crawford seems to emphasize the need for the prior opportunity for cross-examination.
Well, I think if the U.S. Supreme Court was going to do that and say, look, anytime you allow hearsay, you're denying a defendant an opportunity to cross-examine the declarant, because that's what hearsay is. They could have just flat out said, you know, hearsay is improper because it contravenes the constitutional right of confrontation. The U.S. Supreme Court didn't say that in Crawford versus Washington. So we don't know exactly how far the testimonial category goes here, but it's the state's position that we're not dealing with any testimonial type hearsay evidence in this particular case. So I don't think Crawford versus Washington is implicated. When we have a case where they're introducing uncross-examined preliminary hearing testimony, for example, then the issue is probably going to be before the court.
Thank
any
Mr.
additional
Williams.
Questions, I'll try to answer those. Thank you.
I'd like to return to the question about what evidence would be precluded. I had a chance to think about that for a few minutes. And we would suggest to the court, the evidence that the state, they put together an exhaustive case about Schmitz and Banta's relationship prior to the event. They lived together, they traveled together, they were engaged in a criminal smuggling enterprise together. That evidence would went to support the state's theory that there was an agreement to kill him. And there were pieces of evidence after the homicide that they stole the money together, that they hung out together, that they traveled together, that Schmitz posted Mr. Banther's bail. Things like that that were offered simply to establish that disagreement. And despite Mr. Williams' contentions to the contrary, the state's intended theory was made clear when we were arguing this very motion to the trial judge. And Mr. Welch, who was trial counsel for the state, and I'm going to quote him because I'm holding the transcript B-12, the accomplice liability statute refers to an agreement, and I think we can argue that legitimately. And that's what he told the trial judge to convince the trial judge that we were wrong and the state was right.
What do you think about Mr. Williams' point that, well, there could be an agreement and evidence introduced to support it, an argument made about it, simply to lure the victim to the woods? That's not necessarily an agreement to kill the victim, even though there's some language in the transcript that suggests that the prosecutor nevertheless argued there was an agreement to kill.
With all due respect to Mr. Williams, it's a little bit disingenuous. In light of the fact that the state suggested to the jury that the truck was borrowed 8 hours before the event so they could haul the body from the crime scene, now, that doesn't follow Mr. Williams' contention that there was agreement to do something else. That's what the jury was told. That's also quoted in our brief. I can't give you a page citation.
So what you're telling us now is that there's a second trial. All evidence of any joint activity, even unrelated to homicide, between Schmitz and Banther would be out. And basically the only evidence that would be in is that somehow Mr. Banther showed up at the crime scene without any predicate.
I don't know if I'll go that far, Your Honor, but if you're going to introduce that evidence and suggest to the jury this establishes an agreement to commit murder, then that evidence would be irrelevant.
Well, you just... I understand that, but you're now saying the evidence can't even come in.
Yes.
Or are you saying that?
The evidence that these people at one time lived together near Medzeboff Road was introduced to establish the depth of their relationship to support a notion that they were capable of agreeing to commit murder. The evidence that they engaged in a smuggling operation together was admitted to support the notion that these people agreed to kill Dennis Ravers. And all that, those pieces of evidence were tied then
to Mr. Schmidt obtaining a truck 8 hours before the crime. Banther in Washington, D.C., convincing Ravers to travel to Delaware for a meeting.
So if this evidence is admitted, it would have to be for a different purpose.
That's correct.
But it could be admitted for a different purpose.
I'd have to predict the context, Your Honor.
Well, but the thrust of your argument, at least as I understand it, is while all of us who've tried cases know that the same facts can produce inferences that are arguably different, supporting one theory as opposed to another, the crux of your complaint, at least as I understand it, is that by allowing the state to argue there was an agreement, that these facts supported planning and counseling, in addition to other elements that could establish accomplished theory, error occurred because of the prior not guilty verdict on conspiracy. So it isn't so much what was introduced into evidence as the fact that the argument made based on that evidence led the jury to conclude there was a conspiracy, and the charge given to the jury, the instruction, was not precise enough to distinguish those elements of the accomplice statute that did apply to the case as opposed to those that were ruled out because of their consistency with conspiracy.
That's the heart of the argument, Your Honor, but if this is retried under different parameters and the state seeks to introduce some of these pieces of evidence which tie these two men together in pre-homicidal events, they're going to have to give a proffer as to why it's relevant, and we'll be in a better position to address whether or not it is simply a veiled effort to reestablish a conspiracy without using that word.
Well, restrictions on argument and cautionary instruction to the jury about the basis on which they should consider the evidence would take care of it, wouldn't it?
And also, I think...
Yes, sir, would take care of it, yes or no?
I don't think it would completely take care of it. I think that we, in pretrial, we would have to deal with some of these issues as motions in limine and let the trial judge get a proffer from the state as to why they believe now these things are irrelevant. I was hoping to address the proffer issue. I'm happy to do that if the court wants to spend two more minutes.
Thank you, but no.
Thank you, Your Honor.